The past year has been an eventful time for Rhode Island Governor Dan McKee. He won a narrow victory in a five-way Democratic primary last September. Then, in November, McKee crushed Republican opponent Ashley Kalis to win his first full term as governor. The former Cumberland mayor has had the benefit of serving during good times for the state budget, thanks to a gusher of federal COVID aid. But not everything is rosy. Higher interest rates have had a chilling effect on development in Rhode Island. Not everyone embraces McKee's plan for improving public education. And if there's a recession, Rhode Island could take it on the chin. How will McKee confront these challenges? And at age 71, does he hope to seek another term as governor? I'm Ian Donis, and this week I'm going in-depth with Rhode Island Governor Dan McKee. Welcome back to the Publix Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Ian.
This is the first time you've been in since last August. A lot has happened since then. You won a close primary for governor, won a lopsided victory for governor, and you also became a grandfather for the first time. So congratulations on all that.
Yeah, well, I definitely was overshadowed by the women in my life. You know, we got Mabel James was born in January, and of course my mom was a hit during the campaign. My daughter was on The Voice, and now she's pursuing some music in Nashville. So, and my wife Susan had "Happy Birthday" sung by the president in February, early February at the White House. So, yes, it's been a very interesting time, Ian.
To bring things up to the present, you announced plans this week to end the sale in Rhode Island of gasoline-powered cars in, I believe, 2035. A lot of people like this direction that you're following because of the exigencies of climate change. But critics, including some Republicans in the legislature, see this as more an example of big government, and they worry that it will impose more costs for consumers. What do you say?
Well, I say I have the cell phone in front of me right now, and we used to have cords that were, had our phones hooked to. That's no longer the case. This is where the world's going. This is where Rhode Island's going to follow that lead and actually lead it in many ways, whether it's an offshore wind, whether it's the Act on Climate that I signed, where the carbon emissions are going to be reduced on schedules at 2030, 40, and 50. The automobiles, about 40% of the carbon emissions that happen. So, and nationally, the automakers have already set the standard, right? There's companies that are going to only do electric vehicles by 2030, 2035. So that's a long ways away in terms of the technologies and the improvements. So we're very confident that this is a trend that is going to become the actual course of business. And
Let me stop you there if I could, because we've got a lot of issues to cover.
Yep.
You recently outlined your education plan with the goal of reaching the same level of academic performance in Massachusetts by, I believe it's 2030. The emphasis is on having students spend more out of school time on learning. And you've gotten partnerships with the city of Providence and some other communities, and you say there are plans to closely monitor this to see how students are doing. If academic performance does not improve as desired, what is the fallback plan?
Well, first of all, I believe it's going to really work very well. You're going to have buy-in from virtually every community in the state of Rhode Island through their municipal leaders. The idea, as you said, was to set the target to meet or exceed Massachusetts levels by 2030. We also put in there that attendance would improve in our schools, and also that our FAFSA applications would be increasing as well. We left $6 million on the table last year with families who didn't apply. So it's a comprehensive effort, and we believe that what we're going to do is we're going to change the culture relative so that in every household, the goal is every household in the state of Rhode Island will value the importance of learning every single day. And the fact of the matter is, coming out of COVID, we know there's a recovery there that's going to take a great deal of time to make sure that the mental health issues, the health issues, as well as the education issues are addressed. And quite frankly, you can't do that in a normal school day. So all the stars are aligned here, and we're going to make sure that working with the communities, creating partnerships like we announced in Newport, as you said. Now other communities are already signed on. We got four or five more ready to sign on next week. You get a mayor, you get a school superintendent, you get a business, you get a nonprofit that's willing to put the time in and partnering in with the universities and Salve and CCRI. That's going to be duplicated all around the state in any community that wants to get involved, and the indications are that most will.
We see how there's a slowdown on development in not just in Rhode Island, a lot of places because of higher interest rates. You wrote to the Federal Reserve asking them to stop raising rates. What can Rhode Island do? What can the state do to try and move forward projects that were previously announced but that seem to be at something of a standstill, more or less, like the Superman Revitalization Project and the Pawtucket Soccer Stadium?
I have been certainly been very public about the Fed being over-aggressive on interest rates. I think their strategy is wrong for Rhode Island, pushing us more towards a recession and higher unemployment. That's not a good model for us in Rhode Island. We've never done well during a recession, yet we have one of the lowest unemployment rates for a long period of time in the history of the state. Yesterday, we were just to be able to announced that the revenue is as we expected, right around a $600 million surplus. We manage the state. So we've got to be disciplined. And then we ought to use the dollars that are available to keep people working. And that's my goal, is to use the federal dollars, whether it's for road improvements or whether it has to do with bridge improvements, or use the surpluses to invest in our URI, Rhode Island College, CCRI, and in projects like down in Quonset, or whether it's Galilee with the fisheries, whether it's in Providence with the health lab facility, right, a health building, or private public partnerships on the life sciences. So we need to continue to be smart about how we invest our dollars. $45 million alone, working with the General Assembly right now for really planting a seed to expand or to actually create a footprint for life sciences. We need to get the projects done that we can get done. And then where you're indicating where there's private capital that's needed, we need to impress on those individuals that they made commitments to get projects done, and we expect both you mentioned Superman and the soccer, we expect that those developers will follow through and do what they need to do to get the projects done.
In terms of projects getting done, Rhode Island is at the early stage of trying to tackle the state housing crisis. Both you and Speaker Shikarchi, Senate President Ruggiero, have expressed support for moving forward. At the same time, we're at an early stage. So what would success look like in 3 years? What would you consider progress in 3 years on the housing front?
Well, there's layers in the housing area, right? I mean, we're dealing day to day right now with the homelessness issue, right? So a success there would be to have more shelter beds than we need and having that. And that's why we got $30 million asked in the budget this year to address long-term ways that we can control real estate on a state and work with the providers to actually deliver on that issue. As far as the other issues, we do have strategies in place, $250 million of the $1 billion that we got in federal money. We're establishing a housing office, with, as you said, with Secretary Pryor. Hannah Moore is a lead person there as well. But we're going to be hiring into that office if the General Assembly approves what's in the budget this year. So I think success is that you would have a really active, viable housing office in state government that has not existed and will exist once the funding gets passed. And then it's really just progressive type of working with the cities and towns to identify ways that they can add more housing and that we're supporting that and leveraging that $250 million, as I said, to at least $1 billion worth of housing.
Advocates this week held a news conference at the Taunton Avenue Collaborative in East Providence. That's a planned 160-unit apartment complex, a project between One Neighborhood Builders, Family Services of Rhode Island, Crossroads Rhode Island, described as innovative. And they say they need a $28 million state appropriation to move forward. Do you support making that $28 million appropriation?
Well, I'll leave that up to Secretary of Housing and working with me with Stefan. But we need to leverage our dollars, right? So that project right now is only leveraged about 8% with funding that is coming through normal financing. We need to make sure we leverage those dollars. It's a great project. East Providence and Mayor DeSilva has been fantastic in terms of, you know, addressing housing in East Providence. We hope that that every community would follow their lead. So I think it's a viable project. It depends on how, you know, what the how they can bring the funding in. We certainly would participate with them if we knew about that project as we were doing the budget. And I think it would probably have layered in some way into our budget. That came after the fact. So I think that's on the table. I think it's a good project. I think that we should try to figure out a way to make it happen.
What does your gut tell you as we sit here talking today about whether you will seek re-election in 2026?
Well, I think that, first of all, we have some long-range plans. You mentioned the 2030 objective on education. We've talked earlier about our Rhode Island 2030 plan. It's certainly layered in. So I got some certainly long-term commitments to the state and the policies that we develop. We'll make those decisions, down the line in terms of, what makes the most sense in terms of, my family and as well as whether we are continue doing the job we're doing, which we are. We have great momentum in the state, and I'm very optimistic about the future.
Back here in the present, Rhode Island's hospitals face a lot of challenges. The payer mix depends a lot on public funds, which are less profitable than private payers. Attorney General Peter Nerona has been kind of a lonely voice in calling for some long-term strategic planning on the hospital landscape. Are you focusing on that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have people in our office that are assigned directly to the hospitals, working with Teresa Piva-Weed and that whole organization of all the hospitals there. I mean, is that the Women's and Infants yesterday, supporting an expansion there as well. So meeting with the presidents, we've met with the incoming president and down in Wesley, the hospital down there, and talked about exactly what you're talking about. Reimbursement rates are key for them. We're getting information there. So we have in our Department of Health, we haven't taken our eye off that ball at all, no matter what anybody might say.
On a related note, when do you expect we'll have a permanent director for the State Department of Health?
Right now, the permanency of these issues is not as important to me as having good people in place that are actually doing the job. So at this point in time, Dr. Bandy's doing a fantastic job there. We're doing the work, and that's what's most important to me. And is, are we doing the work? And if we have interim directors, that to me, as long as they're skilled and talented, that's all that matters.
We've got to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, Governor Dan McKee.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for the invite.
When CD1 candidate Aaron Regenberg this week called for the impeachment of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, former gubernatorial candidate Ken Block responded on Twitter by describing that as an unrealistic prospect. Block was right about that. With the GOP-held House and a divided Senate, there's little chance that Thomas will face impeachment. But the 1st Congressional District has a strong Democratic tilt, so there could be significant support for Regenberg's viewpoint. His statement marked the first bold stand in the race to fill the seat being vacated by Congressman David Cicilline. Just 3 of the 15 Democratic candidates have run statewide before, and Regenberg is one of them. Another is Lieutenant Governor Sabina Matos, the perceived frontrunner at this stage in the race. With just 4 months until the all-important September primary, the fireworks among competing campaigns will likely flare well before the 4th of July. You can read more about that in my Friday TGIF column, posting around 4 this afternoon on my Twitter, at Ian Don, and at thepublicsradio.org. That's our show for this week. Our producer is James Baumgartner. I'm Ian Donis, and I'll see you on the radio.